This is the current federal tax developments for the week of May the 6th, 2024. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by Kaplan Financial Education and by your state Society of CPAs. Dollars coming to you again from Phoenix, Arizona this week. We're going to look at the following things that happened in the area of federal taxes this week. First, we're going to discuss an IRS fact sheet that came out on disaster provisions for retirement accounts that were added by the Secure 2.0 Act. And also note that many of these only work if the employer updated their plan to add them in. So we will talk about that kind of background. We're also going to look at the fact the DC Circuit reversed the tax court ruling and indicates that the IRS does actually have the assessment authority to assess a failure to file a report under IRC 6038B. If you don't translate that right away, that's IRS form 5471 for ownership of a foreign corporation. And rather than having to have the Justice Department file suit against the taxpayer in district court. So we'll discuss that issue and also maybe a little discussion about what that might mean. Because again, we have a published tax court ruling, you know, essentially a formal published ruling, that is a TC and not a TC memo ruling, that states that no, there is no such authority. But now we have one of the districts, which happens to be the district that the particular case arose out of, one of the, I should say, circuits, essentially saying, nope, tax court, you're wrong. So we'll see how that goes. We also will quickly discuss that there are electric vehicle final regulations have been issued. Won't go into a lot of detail there because that's going to be of a lot of interest if you make electric cars, of somewhat interest if you are a dealer selling electric cars, maybe also of interest if you're manufacturing fuel cell vehicles, plug-in hybrids, etc. But if you're not doing any of those, it's probably not going to be terribly relevant to you. So we'll quickly discuss that and what's going on there. We also have a continuation of something we've discussed previously. We're getting closer and closer to marijuana being moved off of Schedule 1 of the controlled substances list and onto Schedule 3. And why that's a tax issue is because, as we'll discuss, Section 280E only bars the deduction of expenses other than cost of sales for a business that is trafficking in items listed on Schedule 1 or Schedule 2. So we'll discuss where this is, but also the time frame of when, if this change is going to happen. It's beginning to look more and more likely that it will, because we actually had people backing this from both parties, actually in Congress, making statements, even though Congress itself doesn't seem to want to vote to make this move, which they could do. We seem to have enough bipartisan support to effectively leave this in. So we'll see what's going to happen going forward. And finally, we're going to have a case that was, again, a Court of Appeals case, the Seventh Circuit. And this was a case of a taxpayer who was trying to claim the credit for increasing research activity under the provisions found in Section 41A, you know, essentially A1. And we'll talk about the little problem he had because he had no written records of how much time, you know, he had no real records of how much time he himself spent on anything, didn't keep records of how much time he worked on things. And then number two, he couldn't even estimate how much he had spent on qualified research activities, which are the things necessary for 41. As you might guess, not surprisingly, the taxpayer lost this appeal. Hopefully just the court case is misleading in terms of what was there, because you look at this, that's one of those like, why are we appealing this? Like, you know, this is really about as bad as facts can get case for having bad records, but we'll talk about it. We'll also talk about why in this case, you know, the court didn't even need to worry about the Cohen rule. So we'll talk a little bit there on that side. But let's start out with the fact sheet the IRS issued on May the 3rd, entitled Disaster Relief, Frequently Asked Questions, Retirement Plans and IRAs Under the Secure 2.0 Act of 2022. This is fact sheet 2024-19. It was issued on May the 3rd. So basically Friday, we closed out the week. I was kind of active on Friday too, issuing various things, getting them posted, and other things going on. Section 331 of the Secure 2.0 Act provided special rules that apply to IRAs and certain retirement plans sponsored by employers for disaster relief. And they basically went into three main areas. right? They had expanded distribution and taxation relief, essentially allowing a plan to open up distributions in cases where otherwise wouldn't be allowed if the taxpayer resided in an area that met the requirements for a federally declared disaster under the Stafford Act. And then also tax relief, very similar to what we had before, where we spread that over 3 years. You may remember that from the COVID-19 disaster. You have people who took distributions in 2020 related to COVID-19 who met the requirements were able to pay the tax over 3 years and were able to put the money back in as well in those 3 years. So we talk about that kind of background. We also had, as we said, a relief to allow repayment of distributions that were taken for principal residence purchase or construction. That's also something we've traditionally seen in disasters. The IRS offers that, or Congress offers this up. The idea being, I was just took money out of my IRA account. I was going to use that money to purchase a principal residence. I was going to use it for the down payment. And then, you know, disaster happens, things have gone badly. And eventually I either can't buy the house or it turns out the house is not saleable anymore, right? Various other problems. So eventually this falls through, but it falls through more than 60 days after I took the money out, or I've already had a problem, right? Let's say I've already taken a distribution and done a rollover within the prior year. So I no longer have that option open. This is allowing relief there. And third, special plan loan rules that are put in place here. Now, the big deal about Angus and the Secure Act, honestly, although it did change the rules slightly and made them a bit less generous than they had been on previous disasters, was previously these rules kept popping up and they were always one time only for one disaster. The problem is you had to modify your plan every time if you wanted to take advantage of this. So there's a lot of plan amendments, retroactive plan amendments that had to be made. So it was kind of a pain. The theory of Secure 2.0 is to allow you to simply amend your plan. And two things are true. Number one, we know what the rules are going to be, and they haven't really changed much from the various disasters we've been through. And then number two, as soon as you have a qualifying disaster, people start taking advantage of this, not having to wait for Congress to pass a relief bill somewhere down the line that eventually allows you to do this, which of course could take quite a while. So basically this more, if you're going to keep allowing the same thing is what eventually occurred to Congress, probably you should just put it in the law and, you know, just link it to a qualified disaster, which is what they did. Now we'll talk about who can qualify for this relief. This is also standardized. So in order to come under any of these relief provisions, you have to meet the following criteria. Number one, the individual's principal residence anytime during the incident period, which is essentially from the start to the end of the period of the disaster, had to be in the qualified disaster area with respect to that disaster. Of course, in COVID-19, that was pretty easy because pretty much anywhere in the United States, basically everywhere in the United States was covered. Other cases for disasters, yeah, it's going to be more regional. You can't really claim that I was affected by a wildfire in California if my principal residence is in North Carolina. So there is a regional issue there. It's not open season for everyone. And the individual has sustained an economic loss by reason of that disaster. And you may recall, going back to the COVID one, because that's one everybody had to deal with almost certainly, that was true there as well. You've got to demonstrate an economic loss. You've got to be able to show what was your economic loss. And that was one that I saw a lot of people glance over in the COVID situation. I don't know the IRS asked many questions, and some people just decided everybody had an economic loss from COVID. I'm not certain that's the case. I'll even say for me personally, I'm not certain that was the case. I think in some ways, because of the additional work I ended up getting from doing all of these updates on COVID laws, COVID rules, in many ways, and it really didn't affect my practice horribly in that regard. So we were still able, because we were a business that was considered essential, we were able to keep running. I'm not sure I really had a suffering from COVID-19 in terms of economic loss directly related to the COVID-19 pandemic. But still, some people decided to kind of ignore that problem. And I certainly haven't heard of the service doing much examination in that area. I don't think they really wanted to get into that issue either. But economic losses, and in this case, you're probably going to need to show something, right? Because let's say it is a wildfire. Let's say there are wildfires in Maricopa County here in Phoenix. Well, if they don't, you know, if my property is not impacted by it, it's going to be tough to show the economic loss, probably. So it can be loss, damage to, or destruction of real or personal property from fire, flooding, looting, vandalism, theft, or otherwise. And by the way, this list is non-exclusive. So there are, you can argue other ways if you want to. And that's also what makes it a little bit more interesting. Loss related to displacement from your home. You had to leave your home and you had to, you know, get a new place to stay. You had to get temporary quarters, etc. That sort of stuff. Or loss of livelihood due to temporary or permanent layoffs. Now, as I said, it does say not limited to, but obviously these three are the safe harbor. Any of these happen, you qualify under the rules. Now, the big thing to remember is employers are not required to adopt provisions to implement these rules, the expanded loan or distribution rules. And that's important because they have to do it, right? If they don't amend their plans to allow for these distributions, then doesn't matter, the law would let them do so. An employee cannot just take these distributions and be able to utilize these provisions. First, they'll probably not be allowed to take the money from the plan because it won't be an allowed distribution. So remember that. So, you know, don't get people all worked up, or don't tell your clients they have a right to do this until somebody checks and makes sure the employer is adopting this. As I said, the key to this is by allowing it to be adopted one time and not needing a special rule for each disaster, Congress is hoping that this will make it more likely that plans will be amended. Too many times it's just been considered too much of a hassle to make the amendments, and so things don't happen. In this case, you know, they're hoping it'll be something that, yeah, people get the amendments, or probably even worse, in the past, people just did it, but never did those amendments necessary. The remedial amendments, which could be a plan qualification problem, right? You were allowed to do it as long as you amended timely. But I have a feeling a lot of people, especially people who don't have a third-party administrator deeply involved in the plan who's competent, may skip that little problem about amending the plan because that generally costs money. And, you know, people don't like paying money. Now, a qualified disaster distributions are taxed over 3 years unless the taxpayer elects to pay that tax in a single year. So if there is a qualifying disaster distribution, which we're allowed to do, up to certain limits, you know, in essence, you can then spread that over 3 years. You may remember that from COVID, right? You'll file a special IRS form. You will report 1/3 in the first year, you know, the year you take the money, 1/3 in the second year, the year after that, and 1/3 in the, you know, basically the second year after you took the money from the plan. You'll also have the right to return the money within 3 years, right? And when you return the money, if you've already paid tax, because again, you're going to start paying tax year one, right? Unless you start repaying year one. So, you know, if you took out, let's say, $30,000 in year one was a qualifying distribution, you'd pay tax on 10, unless under prior IRS guidance, which should still apply here, you at least repaid 10 grand before you filed the return for the year you took it out. And you'd have, you know, 10, and then the same rule would be for the next year. If you don't have at least 20 grand paid back, then you're going to be in, it'd be kind of weird how those go. And again, it's a little strange because if you didn't pay back the 10 grand, but second year after you filed the first return, but before you file the second return, you pay 10 in, then you get excluded year two because they're trying to avoid amended returns. But obviously, if you actually get to year three and you pay back the whole 30,000, you know, the rest of 30,000, you have to go back and amend year one, which is why we have this 3 year limit, because the statute's still got to be open on the year that you pay tax in. So that's part of the idea here, right? A qualified distribution for purposes of purchasing, constructing, and principal residence is any distribution as a qualified first-time homeowner distribution or a hardship distribution from an employer plan. Okay, so they're very different rules here, right? With an IRA, it's got to be a first-time homebuyer distribution, which is limited in amount and is limited in qualification. Now, as we all know, you don't need to actually have never been an owner of a home to be a first-time home buyer. That's always a weird rule. But you still got to qualify there, any money coming from the IRA. Or money coming from the employer plan, that would generally come out under a hardship distribution that would have been allowed related to this purchase. And if your plan allows for that, it came out for those reasons, then you're allowed to do it under these rules, which essentially is dealing with the fact that you might have taken money out, that now there's not going to be a purchase of a house for various reasons, you know, your economic situation, et cetera. So you get the money, you still have the money, right? And you're trying to put it back into the program. And while from an IRA, if you're within 60 days, you probably can just stick that back in, right? It wouldn't have been a problem previously. You're outside the 60 days, or if it was a hardship distribution, which generally is not allowed to be rolled over, then you have a problem. You're just going to pay tax under without this relief. So it has to have been used to purchase or construct a principal residence in a qualified disaster area, but was not so used because of the qualified disaster. That goes back, if you look in the fact sheet, to what's a qualified disaster. That affected the area. So you used it to purchase or construct a residence. You didn't actually get to take it over because it was, you know, floodwaters, et cetera. It's simply not, you can't live in it anymore, right? It was destroyed, right? Tornadoes, et cetera. It was simply destroyed in the qualified disaster, hurricanes, that sort of thing. So, you know, it's never used. You can go ahead and put the money back in. That's kind of what this allows you to do. And was received during the period beginning 180 days before the first day of the incident period. That's essentially 60 days before the, or I should say 6 months before the disaster was declared. Not exactly 6 months because it's 180 days. And there'll usually be more than, there'll always be more than 180 days in the prior, and it's something exactly 6 months back. But again, very roughly 6 months previously, right? You know, and ending 30 days after the last day of the incident period, which is kind of interesting about you took the money out after that, but then discovered you couldn't. Okay, so there are reasons why that might be true. You might have taken money out. You know, it was going to take money for fix-up and stuff, and then finally just, it's not going to work. So you end up having to put it back in, right? So that's basically where our rules go now. The qualified residence distribution can be repaid ending on a date that is 180 days after the later of the first day of the qualified incident period with respect to the qualified disaster, or the date on which a qualified disaster declaration with date of qualified disaster declaration with respect to the qualified disaster. So whichever one of those is later, normally be the date of declaration, will be later. They don't usually declare them on the first day. Don't declare them in anticipation, right? Oh yeah, an earthquake's going to hit tomorrow. Declare it right now. It's like, now we don't usually know the earthquake's hitting tomorrow. So we have to wait till it hits and then declare, but those are our options. There is a third clause you'll see in there, which says within 180 days after December 22nd of 2020, obviously that's already passed. So that would only get rescued by a retroactive issue. And that's been known since early on. So presumably, we don't have that problem, and you know we're not going to be in that issue with that repayment date. It's already been repaid. Okay, loan relief, and again, like with the distribution relief, a plan does not have to allow this to happen. Don't go tell your clients that they can go borrow from their plan. Tell them they might be able to borrow from the plan after being in a disaster area. Okay? Loan repayments can be delayed up to 1 year. If outstanding on or after the latest of the first day of the qualified incident period or the date of the declaration. So what we're looking here is loans are already out and being repaid, right? So you're repaying your loan you took from the 401k plan and a qualified disaster hits. The plan can provide for a 1 year delay, right, in loan payments. So it could say, I know you have a payment coming up, you know, let's say in 2 weeks. We're going to push that out to essentially up to 1 year later that you'll have to make that payment. So you could have like a 1 year suspension of payments is effectively what's allowed here in this area, right? For any payment that was due from the first day of disaster incident period to the date that is 180 days after the last day of the incident period, due date of the repayment may be delayed for up to a year. So that's what we said. Again, there is that time period once we get out of the incident period, and we are then essentially 180 days out of that. At that point, any payments from that point forward are due at the time. So that becomes effectively your restart date if you're paying in, you know, in terms of you're making payments on installment basis, that's really going to be your date we're looking for. Okay. Now, also additional loan relief, you can increase the loan limit in the plan. Normally, the most a plan can allow you to borrow is, you know, in essence, $10,000 or, you know, 50% of the amount of your plan, you know, 50% of your vested interest in the plan. That's usually the way we're looking at this. Now it's going to be the lesser of your vested benefit in the plan and always capped by the vested benefit. So this was there. So if you only had a $4,000 vested benefit, you could borrow $4,000. The plan could allow for that, right? Or $100,000. So essentially, we're now going to 100% of vested benefit allowed up to $100,000. A plan could allow for that. Now, again, those are the limits. A plan could limit this to a lesser number. So it could say you can only, regard in a disaster, we'll let you borrow more than 50%, but only up to, let's say, 80%. Or we could say up to, let's say, your vested balance, but instead of 100,000, we could limit that to 75 instead of the 50 that it's normally limited to. Okay. Next up, we have a DC circuit is reversing the FARI decision, which we've discussed earlier. This is a case, FARI versus Commissioner, the Court of Appeals for the DC Circuit. Was docket number 231179. The decision came down on May the 3rd. Now, the question becomes, can the IRS assess and administratively collect penalties under IRC 6038B? Now, administrative assessment is what you're kind of used to, where you have the notice of deficiency, you have you're going to eventually, once that's issued, you would have a 90-day letter where you could appeal the case to the tax court. If you don't, if you don't take you up on that, you can pay the amount, and then you could sue in district court for a refund. But that's the assessment authority. Now, there are amounts you might owe, certain penalties for sure, that the IRS doesn't have assessment authority over, meaning that rather the IRS, if you're just not going to pay it when the IRS says you owe it, the IRS would have to sue you in district court, right, to force payment. The Department of Justice would bring suit in district court. The question becomes whether the penalties under IRC 6038B on ownership interest in foreign corporations, the 5471 form, whether the IRS is allowed to go the administrative route for penalties for the dollar value penalties under 6038B, right? This is the amount. This is the one you probably know, the basic $10,000 penalty, which increases to up to $50,000, as I recall, if you refuse after the IRS contacts you, don't file the form in a certain time period. That's there, and it's a penalty that is subject to reasonable cause relief. Now, FARI, not necessarily the most sympathetic facts to begin with, which never helps matters. But he did get the D.C. District Court judge to agree that, or I should say the tax court to agree this doesn't work. So, we'll go there. Now, the case involved $500,000 of penalties for failing to file Form 5471. And he did have a way of trying to hide income offshore by not filing this form, right? He was ignoring it. And so there were some tax issues as well. But the fight right now is over the $500,000 in penalties because he failed to file a Form 5471. The tax court concluded in April 2023 that the law didn't provide the IRS with the right to assess and use administrative collection routes, but rather they would have to sue the taxpayer in the U.S. District Court if the taxpayer says, I'm not paying that. So, they would have to bring suit in court, which is a much more cumbersome process. And, it's going to be a pain to get underway. Now, the advantage for the taxpayer is, of course, that, hey, I can just say no, and now the IRS has to make the decision, is it worth it to sue me? And it's, the cost and et cetera, much more costly process to do it. The IRS appealed this tax court decision, and this case, jurisdiction-wise, would go to the D.C. Circuit, which is where it went. So now we have the case of, the taxpayer and the IRS disagreed on what each contended was the default reading of the language in 6201A. That's what provides the assessment authority. And it does provide the IRS with the right to use the assessment administrative collection authority for all taxes, and then parenthetically says, including interest, additional amounts, additions to tax, and assessable penalties. Okay, now, back and forth on this. So, you know, we know those things are there, right? It was taxes, right? And there's some back and forth on what things count. For instance, we know anything that represents an underpayment of taxes on the return, which could also include things like tax credits, well, they're going to be assessable, right? That's going to be an assessable item. Interest on the tax due is assessable. Additional amounts, which is a broad category, could include a lot of things. But the real issue here is that last clause that says assessable penalties. Now, the IRS contends that including there means, and it generally does in the text of a statute, including is a non-exhaustive list. But they say that penalties basically default to being assessable unless the law clearly indicates they are not. Now, the taxpayer, not surprisingly, reads that opposite. They're saying, no. When Congress included that language in here in 6201A, they meant that penalties aren't normally assessable because it's a section of the code that is designated for assessable penalties, and various other penalties say they have the right to assess, and some penalties say they don't. But they're saying, well, if the penalty itself is silent on the issue, which this penalty is, the one we're talking about here is silent, the taxpayer said, hey, the default here is it's not assessable. The law has to clearly say they can assess it. So each side contends that there's an overriding default rule here. And since this section is silent, the default rule should control. Now, the panel did not buy, or at least did not agree to go down the line of, is there a default rule? Now, obviously, they're going to conclude that if there is a default rule, it is not what Fari argued. So they do go down that path, and they'll try to show that. But they don't agree with the IRS, or they don't actually rule on whether the IRS is right or wrong about the fact that penalties are by default assessable unless, you know, the law specifically says they're not. Because as the court said, they didn't need to decide that to decide this case. And so they didn't decide it. They left that for later. Right? So essentially, they don't need to come to a conclusion if it related to the default provision, at least the IRS version. Obviously, the taxpayer, you have to explain why they're wrong, because if they're right, then yeah, you know, the tax court's correct. Now, they went back to the history of this provision. Initially, when this penalty was added to the code, it was enacted as a reduction in the foreign tax credit that would have been available to the taxpayer if they didn't timely file this form, right? And that is still in the law for certain circumstances, various circumstances. But under the law as it was modified, Congress decided that it was kind of a mess. It was difficult. Calculating that was tough. And there are a lot of cases where there is no foreign tax credit associated with this particular item. So it's like, and in that case, obviously there was no penalty. So what they did, is they decided to change. Now, there's no question that when it was a foreign tax credit reduction only, that directly affected tax due, and that was clearly an assessable item. No question about that. As I said, that still remains in the law. However, the dollar value penalty says it must be reduced by any foreign tax credit penalty imposed on the taxpayer. So essentially, the dollar value penalty is a minimum penalty, right? So effectively, you pay the greater of, you take the hit for the greater of the reduction of foreign tax credit, or, right, the dollar number, the $10,000. Now, the question becomes, you know, does this mean it is or is assessable? They said, look, this is kind of an odd situation. We agree that part of this penalty has to be assessable. The foreign tax credit reduction has to be assessable. We also agree that assessable penalty, right, in order to compute that, right, or basically in order to compute the dollar value penalty, you have to reduce it by the FTC penalty. And because of that, right, it's like, so is it really true that if the IRS asserted this penalty, that to the extent that a foreign tax credit reduction was appropriate in the case, that would go through the assessment routine and could be, and any challenge could be tried in tax court. But to the extent that it wasn't that, you would have to take the case to district court if it were the dollar value amount of it. And that's really going to be an odd situation, because having it in two courts means that the district court case, to a large extent, depends on the tax court decision. That also, that just doesn't work, right, in that situation. And the court kind of paid attention to that to decide what Congress meant. So they said Congress's intent was clearly to simplify the administration of the penalty and coordinate the two penalties they now had. Now, you can ask an obvious question, why is the penalty $50,000 or, if more, a reduction of the foreign tax credit under the old rules? You might have asked why that was there and what was there. I'm not sure, but they didn't do that. And it would have been really nice to have said that, you know, this is subject to standard assessment routines, but they didn't say that. But the panel said it does not make sense that Congress intended to the simplification to result in a bifurcated result. One part assessable, one part not. That doesn't make sense. Why would they have done that if they're trying to simplify things? Why would they have complicated this issue? Now, the response to that would probably be, look, Congress can do any dumb thing they want. Or even they can do dumb things they don't want to do, but because they got the language wrong, they just do them. So I'm not sure I totally, but I understand where the court's coming from. But again, I'm going to understand there may be a question about how this one works. But they also said, look, the reasonable cause defense is allowed for the penalty. And the law clearly establishes there that the IRS first rules on whether there's reasonable cause. Well, again, if this penalty is not assessable, and you don't go through that program, it's difficult to see. You know, it's kind of saying, look, that assumes the IRS has a right to control the penalty, right? In the original assessment of the penalty, they're saying that doesn't also make sense why we have this bifurcation taking place. It just doesn't make sense in their theory. Would also mean that the C penalty, the foreign tax credit, as I said, face tax court jurisdiction, but the B penalty, which is a fixed dollar amount, would go through district courts, which is a little weird. Next up, the IRS publishes in Treasury Decision 9995, issued on May the 6th. Realize you might be listening to this not on a day before May the 6th, but you know, we basically get it pre-publication copy a number of days early, and May the 6th is the date it will hit the Federal Register. So for effective dates and things like that, May 6th will count. But as far as when we know what's in it, it's going to be the earlier time frame that they issue the pre-publication version, which is already available and is available on the Federal Register website. Okay, it deals with these regulations dealt with a lot of manufacturer and dealer rules. They're going to talk about battery components, critical minerals, foreign entity of concern rules. They also have rules for previously owned clean vehicles, including the 5-year look-back rule on that credit. Does that dealer tax compliance issues, especially with that, you know, previously owned vehicle credit, and other various issues related to the manufacturer or dealer for the most part. Now, they did make clear in the final regulations there's going to be an upfront review of compliance with the battery component and critical mineral rules in coordination with rules issued by the Department of Energy. So there is going to be a compliance work done on the documentation that's sent in to help ensure that manufacturers aren't certifying things as qualifying and meeting these requirements when in fact they don't. So they do say we're going to be looking at that, so make sure you're aware of that. There'll be a pre-compliance upfront review, right? But they will give manufacturers a 2-year transition period to remove foreign entities of concern suppliers from their supply chain. And that's going to be true. The real reason for that is simply it's going to take time to do so. Now, in theory, even one foreign entity of concern being involved in your batteries for a very, very minor part of it would blow your entire credit. You know, we get into this fully. They're saying, look, we're going to give you 2 years and not apply this rule during 2 years, but only if you demonstrate specifically how you're going to comply before the end of the 2-year period and how you're going to get rid of that supplier. If you don't have that plan in place, then you're subject to those rules on their normal effective date. But if you do have that plan in place, we're going to give you a 2-year period to phase out, because I'm sure some of them will note they probably have supply contracts in place. And those supply contracts, you know, they may not be able to get out of them in time to meet these requirements. They either have to basically, and I'm sure the other side would push and require them to take delivery of this stuff they can't use, or, you know, and buy additional others, or not qualify for the credit. So they're going to give them 2 years to get that fixed, but they have to have a plan to indicate how that's going to go. So again, if you do have a taxpayer who is a manufacturer in this area, right, or you work for one who is, you're going through this compliance, or you work with car dealers, then you probably want to study the parts of this that affect your situation. But I think for most part, this is probably as much guidance as in a program like this it makes sense to give to these final rules, just letting you know they're out there, right? Next up, continuation of something we've talked on before. I'm quoting an article, which was the first one I got notified of when this happened, but there are now a whole bunch on this. But this was an article written by, contributed to by David O'Valley, Michael Schurer, Tyler Pager, Dan Diamond, and Vineet Neeropally. Probably clobbered that name, I apologize. But it does say the Attorney General moves to reclassify marijuana as a lower-risk drug. That's kind of an update of the headline that was there when I first got it. But it was in the Washington Post online on April 30th of 2024, and they revised it during the day as more details came in. This all relates to Internal Revenue Code Section 280 Cap E, which denies deductions to a business other than, and credits, essentially to a business, other than a deduction for the cost of goods sold if that business is trafficking in controlled substances within the meaning of Schedule 1 and 2 of the Controlled Substance Act, which is prohibited by federal law or the law of any state in which such trade or business is conducted. Now, what's happening here is obviously the question of marijuana is considered a Schedule 1 drug. What's coming up now is it goes back to Health and Human Services, who, you know, sent a recommendation to Drug Enforcement Administration that this particular, you know, that marijuana be moved off Schedule 1 and onto Schedule 3. The DEA has studied that proposal, and this week, because DEA is part of the Justice Department, recommended that, in fact, it be moved from Schedule 1 to Schedule 3, which talks about items that have medicinal value. And so they're subject to more regulation, special regulation, but they will not automatically cause a business to lose the ability to claim deductions, right, in this particular case. And you're involved with any cannabis businesses, you know this is a huge deal, especially when we get to individuals like we're talking about who are retailers, right? The retail aspect of it, the dispensaries, are this is a huge deal. So again, April 30, they recommend it. Now, this does not mean that right now this is all good. We are still in a process. As of today, as the time you're listening to this, unless you're listening to it like a year later, probably, or more, cannabis or marijuana is still a Schedule 1 drug, and you cannot claim deductions for your business expenses. That's not going to change until it gets moved to Schedule 3, assuming that happens. Now, the Justice Department approved the recommendation the same day. So now the what's actually a proposed final rule, because that's basically how it goes through, is off the Office of Management and Budget to basically review it for, you know, basic structural correctness. And then it would be published for public comment in the Federal Register. This is just like proposed regs. They'll be out there for public comment. There'll be a period of comment, consideration by the agency. And then either they might issue revised, final rules, you know, revised proposed final rules, so temporary rules, or they might go final with modifications or without. So various things could happen. So this will not go into effect, and therefore your client's not going to get a deduction for items barred by 280E until such time as the rule is approved, and then we get an effective date for the rule. You have to watch for those and see how that goes down. Now, it's possible they can propose an effective date. That is the day they publish the proposed rule. That could set up a claim for refund. But not until the rule goes final. We'll have to watch and see how that goes. Obviously, there is a huge impact for businesses operating in states where cannabis sales are legal in some form. Not being able to deduct your non-cost of sales expenses is a big issue, right? There are a lot of expenses incurred. And it also sets up the weird situation where, special rules are involved. Like, for instance, because these deductions wouldn't be allowed otherwise, we don't get the UNICAP rules don't apply in the case of, cannabis dispensaries. Now, let me be honest, be clear about one thing. There's a lot of people know that rule. UNICAP doesn't apply. If this stuff moves to Schedule 3, UNICAP will immediately apply, unless you're otherwise exempt, right? For the small business exception, other rules. But unless you're otherwise exempt, UNICAP would apply because that depends. And it's also why you have to understand why rules exist. The UNICAP rule depends on the deductions being otherwise disallowed. If the deductions will be allowed, then bank gang, we no longer have the ability to ignore UNICAP. But also means, weirdly, we're actually trying to shove as many expenses as we can into direct expenses or indirect expenses other than 280, other than basically, the UNICAP expenses. We're trying to shove it into that category so we could capitalize it into inventory, right, for cannabis. That'll also change that whole incentive. I will warn people, too, before you get involved in that and suddenly start moving things out of the inventory account. The IRS come at duty of consistency, right? Sorry, guys, you've already conceded it's an inventory cost. Tough luck. So understand why you're doing stuff, understand the rules, and understand the mere fact that 280E goes away may change incentives for doing certain things, but you still got to justify why you did it the other way before. And the IRS is going to use that concession against you in the future. Or number two, you've got to be able to understand rules that simply are now going to apply to you because the only reason you didn't have UNICAP before was because things weren't deductible. We'll get there. Other catch, this does not make sales legal under federal law, but does allow for certain medical use. So this could get a little messy. This is more the federal law standard. And if we don't get relief for banking, it is possible, though I think unlikely, that some dispensaries that are in medical marijuana states might change their dispensary rules to come into line with federal allowed usage and prescription rules. Or we could see this stuff actually move into, standard pharmacies, things like that. This is a little more complicated there. Again, the catch is most dispensaries, even if it's a medical use dispensary, if it doesn't, they're not limiting it the way the federal rules require for Schedule 3 items to be limited, then that's still going to mean that it's still federally illegal, which may cause you problems with banking and other issues. So keep that in mind. But the big thing is it is going to greatly reduce the federal income tax burdens on businesses, especially dispensaries, if it does go into effect. Dispensaries have, it's just the cost of buying the stuff from your supplier, right, and the freight. And there's really nothing much else that goes to your inventory costs. So, your salaries paid to the people working in the business, your utilities, your rent, everything is basically going to be considered a non-deductible item for those. So the biggest relief will come to dispensaries. So again, if you work with them, keep your eyes on this and keep your eyes on how this moves. But also go back and understand exactly how this losing this is going to affect not just getting deductions for items that you're currently listing as non-deductible, but how it's also going to trip up things like, as I said, the exclusion from UNICAP. I'm sure a lot of people will screw that one up because they'll remember they've been told by me in classes that UNICAP doesn't count, but people tended to stop listening when they got to the why it didn't count. And the why would suddenly matter if this in fact goes through. Let's talk about now, coming down toward the end, let's talk about another Court of Appeals case, Moore versus Commissioner. This is from the Seventh Circuit, docket number 23-6-2681, April 30th, 2024. Okay. The taxpayer had claimed a credit for increasing research activities under Section 41A1, right? But it was relying rather heavily on the president and chief operating officer's supervision of research conducted by this company. Now, everybody agrees, IRS and taxpayer. The taxpayer says he supervised research. The IRS agrees, yep, that's part of what he would be doing. This company, clearly, we agree he did that. But that's where the agreement's going to stop. And that's where things are going to get really bad for the taxpayer here shortly. The IRS isn't even saying he didn't do qualified research, which is what we have to have in order to get the credit. What they're saying is, we have no idea how much. The president and COO kept absolutely zero written records of how he spent his time. So there is no contemporary documentation of the time he spent doing different tasks. He didn't keep such records. They're a pain. He ignored them. That's not surprising, but it's a real problem when you're trying to claim a tax credit based on time. Right? Time and expense. We got to allocate his salary, you know, based on how much of his time was spent in qualifying research activities. And with no written records, that would be tough. But what's even tougher is he also, at trial in the tax court, admitted that he could not estimate even approximately how much time he spent in qualified research, as defined by IRC Section 41D1. And that's what you're going to get the credit based on, is qualified research and increasing your expenditures on that when you're coming under 41A11, your credit, which that's what they're attempting to do. We're not attempting the alternative ways in, so this whole thing depends on showing they had increasing activities, which makes me wonder who thought filing for this was a good idea. You know, you have absolutely no way to document this. Now, I probably should go back to the original tax court case and try to figure out, there's got to be some theory they had and where those numbers come from. And, you know, what exactly did you do? Because right now it's looking really bad, right? You know, he doesn't know how much time he spent on the main thing. Okay. Right. The tax court found that this utter lack of information on his time spent meant there was no way to calculate a proper credit for increasing activity under 41A1. And remember, the burden is on the taxpayer. It's up to the taxpayer to show that they have a right to get the credit and how much it should be. It is not on the government to show that they don't have a right to get it. Otherwise, nobody would have records. Right? Because no records, that there's no way the IRS could prove you didn't. So it's not their job to prove you didn't. It's your job to prove you did. And we did say proof, right? You have to have sufficient records to justify claiming the credit. Or sufficient something. Okay? Now, the taxpayer did not argue they qualified under 41A2 or 3, which do not depend on an increase in research over a base amount. And the real problem here is we have no way of calculating the base. That's the tax court's position. There's no way to calculate the base. So there's no way, even though there are other people that the IRS may concede did qualified research, the director of engineering, the interesting part was, well, they couldn't show this guy supervised him. So that was also, yeah, problem, the guy doing the research, qualified research. You know, they had no way of showing, though, you know, they're contending that this guy did research, you know, the COO and president, but we don't know how much he was doing before. So how do we compute a base, and how do we compute an increase over that base? So that's kind of a problem. And now the appellate panel said, look, the problem was not simply the lack of records, though they made it very clear that was a big problem. And by big, I mean, it's really likely that even if he had been able to say, oh, I can estimate that I spend this much time, we would just likely have turned around and gotten, well, that was self-serving testimony, right? In essence, if the only evidence of your time spent on research is you kind of spitballing a number on the stand at trial, or, you know, spitballing a number on when they were putting the thing together, and you had nothing to back that up, no other way of backing it up, you're probably going to be in trouble. But his total inability to come up with a number under the method was fatal to the claim. They agreed to the tax court. There was no way to compute a credit under the section they were claiming the credit under. Now, and this second part is why Cohen can't work, right? You may remember George M. Cohen, the old lack of records case. Okay? Obviously, I have a lack of records here. We even have a case where, okay, we agree he did research. Now, the problem was he doesn't even agree that he did he doesn't even be able to say he did qualified research or how much he did. And under Cohen, you need a rational basis for estimating. Again, you're going to estimate considering who's responsible for lack of records. In this case, obviously, it's a taxpayer. We're going to consider those circumstances. And that's kind of a problem in these circumstances, what we've got. So the bottom line was no deduction allowed. Again, Cohen wouldn't, even if Cohen could work, which is highly unlikely here it could. But even if it could, if you had a case where Cohen could work, you had enough other information to let it be rationally estimated, when you can't even estimate, you're not going to get it. So this has been the Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of May the 6th, 2024. Current Federal Tax Developments is brought to you by Kaplan Financial Education and by your State Society of CPAs. Again, my email address, edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can contact me there. Also, I do participate in the Connect groups for various state societies, Arizona, Jersey, Minnesota, Illinois, Washington, I look in on, and Idaho. So you can take a look there from time to time. If you have a question, you can post there, and if I see it and I believe I can help, then I may pop in. Otherwise, come back here next week, and we'll be looking at what goes on and what's happened new in the area of federal taxes for the following week on Current Federal Tax Developments.